Pronto! This is Learning Matters, a bridge to practice, and I'm your host, Scott Macklin, here at Studio Yara at Trinity Western University in beautiful British Columbia. Super excited today because we have with us Tony Benton. Tony B is a founder and station manager of Rainier Avenue Radio, super serving and amplifying the diverse narratives and voices of Southeast Seattle's communities. Tony, welcome. Tell me something good.
Wow. You know what? The pandemic and recent social unrest has amplified the need for diverse voices in media. Mm-hmm. And out of that, that is one of the phoenixes that has arisen from the ashes are the voices of Black media and Black journalism speaking on behalf of and for the members of their communities.
Yeah, this series is a series on convening methodologies, holding space for hope and restoration in a trying time. Now, you're someone who's been holding space for a hella long time, as they would say. You know, you've been heard on the airwaves over several stations in Seattle, 206, 253, 360, right? And that could be like Cube 93, Street Beat, or covering sports radio and KJR AM. You know, you've been on this side of the dial, that side of the dial. Now you're doing internet radio. Mm-hmm. And you're doing it in a big way. Talk to me about what you do. What do you get to do on a daily basis? What's your play?
on a daily basis, yeah. I get to take a look at the landscape, and it changes daily. Yeah. And have the flexibility and adaptability to be able to roll with those changes or roll with those punches. And so even though there's always a plan, you know, of what's next and what we're going to do and what we want to do, the ability to not be constricted, you know, with an overlord about what's important and what should be done. And by the same token, you know, again, to not be restricted, let's say, by the availability of a health department resource or a government agency to be able to share information that's important, you know, to our community and by our community and from our community.
Now, you get to work the mic and amplify those voices in a broad way. But I would also argue, from what I know, and we've known each other for a bit now, is mm-hmm. that you work in a very cross-sectorial way. You work across a spectrum. I mean, you serve on the board Thrive by Five. You serve on the board of Seattle Public High School's Radio TV Advisory Committee. You're part of the National Academy of the Recording Arts. You do work with Crosscut, but you also do work with the Southeast Effective Development Seed. So there's a media component. There's an active community component. Those worlds for you work in a continuum. They're not bifurcated. How do you work your activism with your media making?
You know, I don't know. If I would call it activism,
okay,
I just call it existence, and you know, yeah. To be frank, you know, my mere existence is radical for a lot of people, and so I'm not limited to being one particular thing. I have many interests, just like a lot of people have multiple interests. And so I don't see it, you know, as making an effort to intrinsically intermingle all of these things into one thing. It's just, you know, hey, here's something where I'm interested in and maybe I can have an impact. Here's something where somebody has asked me to get involved or be involved. And I've made the decision that, yes, I can do this if there's something that I can lend my voice to. And music has always been an interest. I think you know that.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of ended up that way. And, you know, and with Thrive, you know, and the focus on early education, that came into my purvey, if you will, because I had a daughter, and it changed my outlook, you know, on what it meant to be a parent. And again, what are the things that you should put into a child? How do you grow a healthy child? You know, so, you know, man, as life comes at you, you can either dodge the balls or get out of the way, get hit in the face and learn from it, or try and catch a few of them.
Yeah. And in life, you end up doing probably all of them. And, you know, catching a few in the face sometimes happens as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So to play on the music metaphor a little bit, you know, there's this line, we can fix it in the mix, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I think fix it in the mix has led us to what we really see, the prison industrial pipeline, if you will. We can't fix it in the mix. We have to get those tracks recorded. In fact, we have to do a much better job preparing even before we step into the studio to record.
Yeah.
Talk to me about what are some of the things that Thrive by Five are doing in order to create a disruption to that prison industrial pipeline that's so systemically built in to the fabric of things these days.
Well, you know, unfortunately, after I think 17 years, Thrive doesn't exist anymore. Whatever you want to call it, I guess on the one hand, you might say integrated. On the other hand, another agency came in, you know, and we gave them our things, if you want to call it that, an ounce of prevention from Chicago. So that's now what it was. So I'm no longer on the board of Thrive. But what still, and that same early education focus, is the fact that there are some things that you can do right from the very beginning, you know, that are more, you know, among other things, cost effective. We know that money put into early education cuts down on the money that you will spend later on in prisons. We know that by again committing the time and energy from birth into our youth and our children makes a big difference in their outcomes. And I'm sure that you've heard that, you know, people look early on and at certain ages and say, well, how many prisons do we have to make? Well, the reality of it is that you can go into a kindergarten classroom and you can kind of tell which kids are going to have problems later on. And again, we know that the brain development, you know, 85% of brain development is done by the time a child is 3 years old. I think they say 90% by the age of five. And so a lot of things happen. It's important to make those synapses connect in the earlier years. So we have a lot of information, you know, and having research-based evidence is one thing that you have to have in order to make some of those mountains move, in order to make things happen. And so that's what a lot of what Thrive did was pull together the folks who could get this research-based evidence so that the money was behind the intention in order to cause the effect that we wanted to have happen, which at the end of the day was just, you know, sharing the information that parents are their children's first and most important teachers. Yeah. You know, and it may seem like that's oversimplifying it, but when you are in a society where in a lot of instances, both parents have to work, you know, well, then now what's going on with your early education system, what some folks would call daycare system? You know, if those are the folks who are essentially raising children, how well trained are they in understanding these things? And again, these are some of the people who are on the lowest paid rung of society. And so we have to make sure that we provide them with the tools and the skills And at the same time, you know, let parents know that there are some very, very simple things that you can do. This isn't rocket science. This is just engaging your child, talking to your child, understanding the emotional and social needs of your child, you know, and in particular, like I would tell fathers who, you know, historically, a lot of times fathers are less engaged and they think, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. I'll play with my child when my child can catch a ball. Well, no, you don't have to wait until then. You can be your child's first toy. You know, you can be your child's first trampoline. You know,
hop on, pop.
There you go.
Other people have said this, but I attribute it to my grandmother, because this is who I used to always hear it from. And she would always say, no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And what you were just talking about, those care providers doing probably, some may argue, I would argue, some of the most important work that we need if we're going to have a society rooted in well-being. Yet those providers are some of the least cared for people in society. How do we flip that script?
You know, that's a good question. And the pandemic really exacerbated that concern because everyone wanted to get back to work.
Right.
Open society up. Well, you know, on the other hand, they need daycare. They need childcare in order for that to happen. And it became very clear that we weren't doing enough to protect, you know, those who take care of the youngest people in our society, our future. You know, were they frontline workers? Were they essential workers? Well, when we needed to get back to work, they were. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I think that that's, you know, one thing that doesn't change the problem, but at least that definitely created awareness to the essential importance, you know, of the people who are, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it, because it's what's happening, raising your kids 8, 9, 10 hours a day while you're at work. What does that look like? And it's also something that has an economic effect, because the more money you have, the better choices that you can make, you know, in those decisions. If the least money you have, well, you may be in a position where you just need a family or a friend member just to take, you know, your child for a little while you're at work. And again, if you're talking about in those early formative years where we know the brain is going bananas and it's crazy and it's the biggest learning time, you know, ever, some opportunities may be missed out on. And so it is nice to see that now there is such an emphasis placed on the concept of early education, and that we further understand the impact and the role that those child providers, child care providers play in our society. How do you make it more important? You know, I think ultimately at the end of the day, that comes down to community. You know, I don't know that you can mandate that through government or through any type of legislation. You can try, but communities, understanding that importance. And that kind of happened, you know, when we went into isolation and there was internet learning. Some families were able to afford the opportunity for what they called learning pods, where 5 or 6 would get together, you know, and then have additional learning opportunities. Everybody wasn't able to do that, but sometimes those things align themselves in that way. So I don't know that there's a big answer. We've been there is no silver bullet. You know, right. I'll just put it that way. There is no silver bullet. And, you know, I've had the good fortune to be able to go to the UK and take a look at their early learning and education system. And then the same thing, you know, I had the opportunity to go to Finland, where they have one of the leading brain research institutes in the world. And for the most part, they have an incredibly educated society, and they don't start school until they're 7 years old. You know, and we say 4 or 5, everybody get in there and do this. They don't start school until they're 7. And by the time they're 9, they're the best readers in the world. So there's a lot to learn. Now, there's some downsides to that as well, because there's such a homogenous society. There's a lot of things that they don't have to deal with that we have to deal with,
right.
Which are cultural differences. And then as they grow and they get out into the world, it's also shown that they have a hard time dealing with those cultural differences, once they're in a different environment. And so there is no silver bullet. I think that, again, it comes down to, at the end of the day, sharing this understanding that parents are the child's first and most important teachers.
So this is Learning Matters, A Bridge to Practice. And again, we're doing a series on holding space for hope, healing, and restoration, talking with Tony Benton, Tony B. And I want to talk a little bit now about Rainier Avenue Radio. And on your website, I'm just going to read it straight up. Rainier Avenue Radio is your South Seattle community radio station and digital media hub. We are proud to serve Seattle and surrounding communities with opportunities to engage with critical issues, compelling stories, and quality entertainment by members of our community. And we'll continue to broadcast live from our communities. Talk to me about how you got involved in the creation of Rainier Avenue Radio. And then I want to ask you some questions about impact and what you're doing.
Well, I'll tell you, and you know, Scott, I don't pull any punches. So I did 20 years in major market radio.
Yep.
I had the opportunity to watch radio go from being something that was essentially mom and pop, you know, entities. And then the Telecommunications Act happened in 1995, and it changed everything. At that point, you were able to own multiple media entities in one area. And so what happened was big companies started buying up all the radio stations, and it changed the way that radio worked. Now, I was part of that process, so I understand that. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to radio stations being owned by an entity in their community or with an understanding of their community, you had four or five big companies, you know, essentially creating the messaging for the entire country. And it changed the way that radio works. So after 20 years, I was done. And I think they were done with me too. and so then the opportunity came in 2011. The FCC released what were called low power FM radio stations.
Yep.
And made those available in urban communities. They had been available in rural communities because they needed the the community communication. And so I partnered with an entity. We applied for a low power FM radio station, and we got it.
Yeah.
I was on the board. And so at that point, you know, the board was, well, like, Tony, why don't you, you know, build the radio station? So I recused myself from the board to start building out the radio station, the precursor to the FM station, which I thought at that time we should build an internet station while we were trying to get the license, finalize the license. Got the internet station up and running, and I would say within a week, the entity that I partner with, and I mean, it is what it is, it was SEED, Southeast Effective Development, wanted more control over what was going on over the airways. I had just done 20 years of major market radio, and so I wasn't in the mood for propaganda radio.
Right.
And so I became the gatekeeper. At a point in time, they actually changed the locks so that I had no access to the studio. You know, I was like, okay, well, I'm not doing this. And so they said they wanted to renegotiate. And I said, no. The staff who I had put together, I told them, hey, you know, I'm not doing this. This is not why I started this. And the five volunteers who were, you know, working for me at the what was trying to be what is still 105.7 FM that was supposed to broadcast in issues for our community. They came with me, and a month later, I was broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week over the internet, because for me, it was always about broadcasting in the interest of the community and providing opportunity for voices to be heard, providing opportunity for folks who wanted to be engaged in their community to have an outlet to make that happen. And, you know, there was also it began to be a shift in the technology. and folks became more comfortable with using the internet. Now you throw in the pandemic and everybody got pushed into this lane right, right. that we had been in for 3 years. And because there was a crisis, what we did for the community, the trust that the community had in us, what I'll call community currency, became evident because they needed information. And so it exponentially grew our radio station at that time. And so that's really, you know, what it was. And I share that as part of the journey because it's not just what I have found was that those low power FM radio stations that were supposed to be for small communities, eventually the same thing happened. They became white owned media properties because those are the people who had the time and the energy to vest into bringing it to fruition. And so it didn't ultimately serve, you know, diverse communities. They're still not serving diverse communities. And there are, you know, in the foreseeable future, there aren't going to be any more FM frequencies released by the government. And so I've been railing against that, you know, because we should not have to be in the position where once again, we have to ask white media for permission to share our story. And so the internet gives the flexibility to be able to do that. And so that's why I'm here today with Rainier Avenue Radio and utilizing the resources that we can through our broadcast media network to make sure that voices are shared, voices are heard. And in case of South Seattle, what we do is we act as a mirror. So we just reflect what's going on in our community. If you don't like what's in the mirror, that's what's going on. If you like what's in the mirror, well, that's what's going on.
Yep. You know, I come from a tradition of working what I call community-centric storytelling, where you're telling stories with community. You're not telling stories about a community or for a community. You're not there to get the story or to take the picture. Those are extraction models, and extraction models always lead to the type of co-option that you were talking about. And how do we reverse that? Well, we root that in community. And one of the things that you do, one of the mechanisms that you create to generate that type of vibe is that you do a lot of digital media training for members in the community. So they become the storytellers. Talk [S2] Yes. [S1] To me about that type of development and that type of capacity building, because that's an important focus of what you do.
Yeah. And, you know, so initially with the goal in mind of, okay, let's put together a community radio station. You know, one of the things that I had to reflect on is that I was always, you know, pretty much the only person of color, let alone Black person, in a director of management position in my career in radio. Right. And that in itself created barriers, you know, where people have, whether they're conscious or unconscious, biases about who they hire and what people should sound like and how they should present themselves. And people tend to say, OK, you look and sound like me. This makes me comfortable. So I'm going to hire you. Right. And that wasn't me, you know. You know, so from there, it just became a matter of, OK, well, how's this going to work? We have to make sure that our youth are engaged and involved and understand that there's a potential and possibility for them to be involved in media. And that's when I realized that there wasn't anything out there. So we could have this 21st century radio station and nobody in our community who was prepared to operate it. And so, I checked around, okay, what other opportunities are there? Where are youth being trained? And it really wasn't happening. And so, before I even started the radio station, at that point, I realized we had to change that. And I started the Creative Arts Digital Media Academy, the CADMA program, which was really an overview of all of the different potential opportunities and possibilities there were out there. And so we taught everything from communications and journalism to app design and web design, film, photography, broadcasts, social media, understanding the analytics behind social media. And it was an overview. And then they also had a class project that they had to complete that they whenever they'd start the class project, they'd say, there's no way we're going to be able to do this. by the time the class was over, they had created incredible works that were a benefit to the community. And so we started that, and we started it at Rainier Community Center, and we had kids all day. Shortly after we had just gotten started, the Rainier Vista Boys and Girls Club said, "Hey, can you do this up here?"
Yeah.
And then shortly after that, I was actually contacted by the school district and said, "You know, we can use this as an after-school program." So it didn't start out with me thinking this is something, you know, that I want to. It was a need. And that's what happens when you start filling the needs of the community as opposed to telling the community what the community needs. And so from there, you know, we began to offer math and coding classes that we offered every summer, along with our comprehensive media journalism classes. We offer classes for seniors specifically who may not have seen themselves being engaged in the internet because they thought if they hit the wrong button, they'd blow the laptop up or computer up. And so we started offering adult digital literacy classes. We offer classes now in Mercer Middle School, Meany Middle School, Washington Middle School, Rainier Beach High School, Franklin High School. We offer classes in Mount Lake Terrace High School, Sierra Summit High School, Rainier Valley Leadership Academy.
Yep.
And, we're planning on continuing to grow that. And again, with the adaptability and the flexibility to say, okay, like the learning environment changes. So we don't have to go through the whole big process to say, how do we do something quickly to make sure that our students are learning? And we were able to put together a curriculum as an example over the last election season where we taught youth important information about voting and critical information, because you have 16 and 17 year olds who get the right to vote at 18, and they're thrown into this world with no real information. You know, civics classes aren't what they used to be. And so what is voter suppression? All the things that we started to see take place after this last election. And we were able to teach those classes statewide to high schools who said, "Hey, this is great." At first, I thought that we would run into opposition, but they ended up welcoming us to be in. And I made the classes short, 5 sessions that were an hour apiece. And when students finished the coursework, they knew more about the voting process, why they had the right to vote, how important it was to vote. And of course, more than just a presidential election, your local elections and the things on the ballot, like the referendums, et cetera, where you can have more of an impact on your community. These things are important. And you can pre-register so that at 18, you automatically are registered to vote.
So this is Learning Matters, a bridge to practice. I want to dive. I don't know if the metaphor is backstage or into the kitchen or into the studio. You talked about curriculum and curriculum development. So I want to geek out a little bit on curriculum development. When you're planning to put together a course, what are the first steps that you take in identifying whether you want to call it a learning goal or an outcome, and then design to that? Take me into your process a little bit.
Well, you know, it's okay. If I don't know how to do this, how can I effectively learn how to do it? And that's really, you know, where it starts, you know, taking into consideration that a lot of times the audience that we're going to be trying to share information with may have some barriers or challenges. The information that we want them to have, they may not see as significant and important to them. And part of what we have to do is we have to show them why this can be important to you today.
Right.
Because if we're talking about something that you can do 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and the heat ain't on, it doesn't make a lot of difference. If we are telling you about how you can prepare yourself for the future, but you're coming to school hungry, you're not ready to learn.
Right.
And so we take real life circumstances and interject those into the learning curriculum so that students feel like they're getting something out of it. You know, that when they leave a class that day, they have information that they can share with their peers, that they can share with their family about how they are growing, what they are learning, and connect that to their issues and concerns. So that they can begin to feel like, you know what, I can be part of the sphere of influence. And that's important, because if you don't believe that, then you don't have hope, which means you're hopeless.
Yep.
You know, and that changes the whole thought process about learning. And, you know, it's one thing to learn to get a job. It's another thing to learn to pass a test. It's another thing to learn to get a degree. But it's amazing to learn just for the joy of learning.
Yeah. How do you instill, once you're able to establish that connection where the learner sees the relevancy of that lesson, how do you create that pathway so they can see themselves emerging, as you say, learning how to learn, but learning how to learn so they can adapt to those conditions, so they're the ones who are driving their story, if you catch my meaning. How do you create that process where students envision who they want to become?
Well, you know, I start off by telling them, y'all are media content providers.
Yeah,
that's what you are. You're media content providers. And so the process of understanding, as an example, where information comes from. And so if you have a group of youth, for example, who are using TikTok, are using Twitch, are using Twitter, are using all these platforms. And then you say, OK, well, who's in charge? And then they see that all the CEOs are male and white. how can you trust the information that you're getting? How can you trust that you are in utilizing this tool, not being taken advantage of it, and this works for you? So that's part of the process. You know, it starts out by saying, where do you sit in this vast landscape of media and content information sharing? So you need to be the Twitter. You need to be the Facebook. You need to be the information resource that you share information with your friends, your family, and your peers. And so that's a big part of establishing that connectivity, is letting people know where they sit, you know, in the scope of where media is concerned and where you get information from and who gives you that information. And that makes it easier to say, okay, let's talk about misinformation. Right. You know, and how that happens. And if you're getting information that is misinformation and you share that with someone else, well, they have the same misinformation. So it starts with understanding some, you know, some very basic things, you know, what is opinion? What is fact-based opinion? And what are facts?
Right.
And so starting out with, you know, with those kind of lesson plans to engage, and you couple that into, where are you at today? You know, what's your capacity to learn today on a scale of 1 to 10? Because if your capacity to learn today is at a 4, our instructors can't teach you like it's at a 9. You
know? Right.
And so that all becomes part of it, you know, and it requires a holistic approach, you know, into the folks who you're trying to share information with.
As a media creator, how important is active listening?
Wow. it makes all the difference in the world, as you say, passive listening. If you're an active listener, or if you can get those who are listening to you to be active listeners, they're more likely to engage. They're more likely to be concerned and care about what you're talking about, they're more likely to understand if you have a call to action, and they're more likely to act
right
on that call to action. And so that's part of the whole, you know, concept of broadcasting. It's how do you turn passive listeners into active listeners? So it is a critical element, at least as far as I'm concerned, when you're talking about broadcasts, and that is understanding also your audience and who that is. Now, that doesn't mean that you just broadcast to the people who think like you. That means you also have the ability. You also have to have the ability to connect with people who disagree with you, you know, and people who think differently than you do. And that is certainly a way, you know, to create conversation. And those conversations may not always be easy. Sometimes they can be very difficult and they can be uncomfortable. But that's when you know that you're making progress.
So I want to ask, and I haven't quite thought this through, so I might need a little help. So broadcast creates transmission, and you worked in commercial radio for 20 years, so you're transmitting. Now that you are playing in this internet space, the possibility to go from just transmission to transaction to even transformation, what is that step to get to? Is the step engagement? How do you move from just transmit to transform?
Well, again, it's part of understanding the basic fundamental concepts of what you're trying to do. And so if you're talking about the internet and you're talking about communication, then you also have to start understanding e-commerce, you know, the amount of money that is now transferred digitally, that is made digitally, that becomes a big part of it. As you know, you used to see something on the internet and then you would have to do something. You would have to get up, go somewhere and buy and physically be in someplace and purchase something. We don't have to do that anymore.
Yep.
You know? Now you see it on the internet, you put it in your cart and you buy it. And so
I was going to understand. You see this? This is a clip that goes onto the end of a fretboard of a guitar so I can put a camera on to film while I'm playing. I mean, this was a late night purchase that showed up on my feed. I went click and it showed up the next day. I'm like, yeah. What?
And that's it. So, you know, it's not just one thing. It's a number of things. Yeah. And so part of it, again, is knowing who your audience is. And so if our audience is engaged through using social media, then we just have to show them that next step that, you know, hey, this is also a way for you to create income.
One of the questions I really love to ask during a conversation of Learning Matters is there an influential teacher that you would like to talk about? Someone who could have been in the classroom or out of the classroom who had an impact on who you are now?
Well, you know, that's an easy one for me, and I'll give you probably some of the answers that you're looking for. But the easy one for me was my mom. Hmm. You know, that's where it stemmed from. That's where it came from. And also from that, you know, I knew that it was also okay for me to go outside of the home to look for things that I needed. And I'll tell you, there have been a number of individuals who probably don't even know that they've had an impact on me. And I've had the good fortune of being able to find them later on and sharing that with you. So one name that folks might know is former King County executive Ron Sims. Hmm. And at the time, I was just looking for inspiration and black male role models. And I would ask to meet with people and they would say no. And, you know, I was, you know, just the late teens, you know, and they would say no. And I figured, OK, well, this is it. And I remember Ron said, yeah, I'll meet with you. He was King County executive at the time. And just the fact that he said that he would meet with me, and then we met and we had lunch and he paid for it. that was a big deal because it made me realize how critical it is to be available for your community, not just when it's convenient. and so Ron and I, you know, we don't go out and have, you know, coffee or anything, but we always enjoy seeing each other. And I finally, after years, told him how important that was for me and understanding, you know, maybe who I wanted to be. Another gentleman, his name is Robert Stevens. And when I was a senior in high school, you know, and I don't mind sharing this story because there are other people out there like me. I actually thought that in September, remember, I was a senior in high school. I thought that in September of the following year after I graduated, I would be able to go to the University of Washington and just enroll. I was a senior in high school. Robert Stevens was a counselor. He says, what are you doing after high school? I said, oh, I'm going to the UW. He said, have you turned in an application? I said, oh, no, I'll do that when I go sign up. He said, come into my office. And awared me of what I needed to do, helped me with the paperwork, helped my family with the paperwork, helped us with the financial aid. And lo and behold, of course, at this time, there was also something called affirmative action that afforded me the opportunity to get into the University of Washington. Had he not done that, had he not taken the initiative, then the whole course of my life, you know, could have potentially, you know, been different. I don't doubt that I would have been looking for growth opportunities. But that certainly afforded me the opportunity to realize that I was very smart. And I was I love to learn. I was, uneducated. And uneducated, not just academically, but uneducated in how systemic oppression worked. Right. Uneducated in what a high level white privilege was in its dominance over our futures. And so being in that environment as one of the few black students on the campus at the University of Washington and watching how these systems work, you know, and watching the level of comfort that white students would have because their instructors and teachers looked like them, knew them, had shared identity with them, and realizing that I was, again, like I said, my existence was radical, you know, and really fully realizing those things and the impacts that those were on society, you know, had a tremendous impact on me and what I thought that I should do and my place. And so I knew that I did not have the same, I was not afforded the same luxury to just say, hey, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do with my life. I was accountable to people in my community. I had to be accountable to others who may have been in the same position. And that also, if there were things that I was able to accomplish, I had to leave behind some sort of blueprint, you know, so that someone else would not have to go through the same things that I had to go through.
So, Tony, we've reached the point of the conversation where we're going to give the Yara wheel a spin. You ready?
Born ready.
Which living person do you most admire?
What is it that you most dislike?
When and where were you happiest?
Which historical figure do you most identify with?
How does your faith show up in your teaching?
What is your greatest extravagance?
What is your most treasured possession?
Which talent would you most like to have?
What is your greatest fear?
Okay, landed on which living person do you most admire?
Ooh, which living person do I most admire? well, again, this may not seem like the answer, but living person that I most admire is my daughter. Mm. She has had to deal with being my daughter. You know, that in itself, you know, sometimes places pressure on her and expectations on her because of who her father is. You know, when she's, you know, 1.5 years old, because of what I do, you know, she had the opportunity to meet Cicely Tyson. When she's 2 years old, she had the opportunity to meet Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, because I was placed in certain positions. You know, she felt, you know, like, okay, I have to have a certain level of accomplishment. And so, you know, she spends 12 years of her life preparing for college. And then in the senior year, 2020 happens and has to finish the last half of her year remotely learning. And then, you know, getting into 7 of the 10 colleges that she applied for, which was incredible. Again, remember, for me, I found out as a senior. So for her, it was a completely different process, you know, and so, you know, doing all the research and making all these happens, getting into 7 out of 10 colleges and then getting scholarships at the ones that she was accepted to, and then finally narrowing her choices down. And then we also went to visit campuses, and that was really exciting. And so she's really looking forward to this opportunity to be independent and for growth. And then deciding between Howard University and the University of Southern California, which were her two top choices that she had. And then she can't go. You know, she ultimately picked USC, and they have a transfer program with Howard. And she can't go.
Yeah.
And she has to learn remotely. And you know, Scott, you know, part of the growth, part of the experience is that social engagement, mm-hmm. you know, that ability to be around your peers and your friends and make friends and learn about those situations. You know, it's incredibly important to the learning and growth process. So, but through that, you know, she's managed to continue to thrive and deal with it. And so I'm just really proud of her being part of that first cohort of learners that had to do it, you know, remotely. And also, as I've mentioned to you, you know, I offer classes. And so I thought, hey, wait a minute. In addition to going to school, how'd you like to teach curriculums? Because you know what it's like to learn remotely. You were the first group. You know, and so you understand what it is to be on the other side of someone teaching you, you know, remotely. And that worked out to be phenomenal. And her and another student ended up being incredible instructors. So she was also able to work and adapt again, as opposed to having to physically go out and get a job, you know, somewhere. She was able to adjust to the climate that we were in right now. So that's what I would have to say. So if that sounds like, you know, father's pride, unashamedly, I'm cool with that. It inspires me and encourages me to let me know that when there are obstacles or challenges that are in front of me that I don't think that I can handle, then, you know, figure it out.
So as we wind down this conversation, I always want to leave room, as much room as you would like, to talk about ongoing projects or things that you would come to mind. But I want to highlight one of the things that you sent me that went, oh, man, I got to be talking to Tony on the show, is that you've got this amazing playlist for what you're going to be doing with Black History Month. I'm just looking at it. I mean, Simon's going to be showing One Vibe Africa, his film. I see Benjamin Hunter. I mean, you got... Dude, this is awesome. Talk to me about what's coming up for the month and what you guys are doing.
Well, cool. And thank you for the room and space to do that.
Yeah.
Black History Month, you know, is and has always been incredibly important. It hasn't always received the space that it needs in our society. And as a matter of fact, after the election of President Barack Obama and conversations about a post-racial society, there was a lot of questioning of whether it was even important, you know, to continue to have Black History Month. Well, again, we learned through the pandemic and through the uprisings that took place following George Floyd's murder that these things exist. And they have always existed, and they were there. And so with that thought in mind, as we approach Black History Month during a pandemic, and what traditionally happens is folks gather. Well, again, we're still in a pandemic. But it made me realize, well, you know what? Let's change the focus from planning for one massive event on one day where you have to do all this stuff, and then you have to try to get people to show up, and then you have to try and sell tickets. You know what? We can just go straight into folks' homes with information, and we can do something bigger and broader than one thing, rather than just a focus on slavery or just a focus on civil rights or just a focus on racism. We can create a broader picture of the Black experience, because being Black is a number of things. And so we created an entire month of events for people to attend and get information. And I call it the celebration and education of Black history. So we'll have critical discussions on issues. We'll have town hall meetings on things that are impacting and affecting our community. We'll have showcases of music. And Benjamin's part of that. Yeah. And the diversity of music. We'll have showcases on dance and dance exhibitions. and of course, you know, we'll talk about every Friday. We're going to have what's called Friday Family Black Film Night. And that's where Simon's film One Vibe is going to be showing their film. Yeah. We'll also host panel discussions, a couple of those on sales, marketing, and distribution of films, and then also and racial equity in the Seattle film industry. We're going to show celebrations of Black history from Paris, France, celebrations of Black history from Vancouver, British Columbia. And then we're also going to take a look at a number of different countries in Africa and how they view race and what the relationship with race is with them as opposed to our relationship with race. And I could go on and on and on. I'm excited about our ability to host the Hartsfield quilt collection, which is the oldest collection of slave quilts in, wow. You know, African slave quilts. Anywhere. And then we get to broach that concept of something called the quilt codes, which for white academia, they don't believe exists. They don't think that that slaves of African descent apparently were smart enough to hide messages in quilts directing their peers who were running away or looking for a safe space about where to go or how to do it. Well, you know, of course it wasn't written down. If it was written down, not only would it not have worked, we would have been killed. But coming from a tradition of passing information down orally, we know this exists and we have it. And so in this quilt collection, you know, we have a quilt in this collection that dates back to, I think, 1861. And so that also, you know, talks about, you know, the importance of quilting, which is a tradition and culture in lots of different cultures. So there's a lot of things going on, Scott, within this month. You can go to our website at RainierAvenueRadio.world and see the entire calendar of events that are taking place and conversations that are taking place and presentations that are going to be taking place. You can participate in some of the workshops and panel discussions. And again, just trying to provide kind of a bigger, comprehensive, holistic picture of the celebration and education that go along with Black History Month.
Yeah, we'll definitely put the link in the show notes. And, you know, one of the frames for this series is holding space for hope, healing, and restoration. And you talk about your work as amplifying voices. I want to go back a couple weeks, inauguration, and there was a voice who just took the stage and rocked it when Amanda Gorman gave her words. And just lit it up, right? I also want to make the argument, though, that in cities throughout the United States, there are youth right now who are speaking truth to power, who we may not know or may not have heard of, who are bringing it and dropping the mic with as much energy, as much wit, as much sophistication as Amanda, and having a platform for those voices also to rise up in the conversation is really, really crucial. So with what you're doing with this playlist, I think is steps in that direction, because man, if we ever need light to shine, we need the light to shine now.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what it is. And that's really what Rainier Avenue Radio is. It is a platform for voices of our community. We don't, if you don't like what they're saying, that doesn't mean it's not happening.
Right.
You know? If you don't like the way that it's being presented to you, you know, that's because that's how people are being impacted. And so that's what they're expressing and that's what they're showing.
Yeah. Well, Tony, I just want to, you know, thank you so much for taking the time and having a conversation. Looking forward to engaging with all the events you have coming up this month and beyond this month. And just special big props and encouragement to your daughter. This is an interesting time to be entering into education. Yeah. But, man, she's going to rock it.
Cool. Yeah. And I hope, Scott, that what Black History Month, what this, you know, Black History Month series of events does is engage people to learn more throughout the year, you know, rather than just hyper-focusing on one thing and saying, okay, good, I got it. Know that there's a lot and you can't do it all in one month. And so if you see a lot and you go, wow, I can do this, but I'm not going to be able to do that, do it in March. Do it in April. Do it in May. You know.
Well, what I think is, and why I think a dedicated month is so important, is that if we're going to learn to listen to understand before we listen to respond, right? We need to have a shift, and a month gives us ability to readjust our hearing, to invite things that, at least, you know, again, full disclosure, I'm white, male, cisgendered, heterosexual. I mean, I have a cup of privilege that also creates a lot of blind spots, right? So a month like this, even though this month isn't necessarily geared for me because it isn't about me, but it creates the possibility to make a shift so that the months to follow can be different. And I can start walking in different ways and maybe interacting in ways that are more geared towards justice and less geared towards self-gratification. So that's why I think these months are important. But again, like you said, it's not just this month. It's beyond.
Yeah. And it is about you, because it's about us. And we have to get to a place where it's not just Black history. It's American history.
American history. That's right. Yeah. Well, again, Tony, thanks a lot for the conversation. Looking forward to the chance when we get to actually be together, break some bread and share a meal.
Good to see you again, Scott.
Yeah. Again, you listening to Learning Matters, A Bridge to Practice, and we'll be talking together again real soon.